Chip!
What?
Easter Sunday, Chip. We're going to church.
What? I'm not going to church.
You're going to church. Now hurry up. I don't want to be late. It's embarrassing.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 295 for the week of March 23rd, 2020. I am Cold Pepper, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Shell Shock Brat, Sarah D. Bunting.
I don't like it here.
And Bent Neck Lady, Tara Ariano.
I need a massage, among other things.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Extra Hot. Great, it is an all-canon episode. We have three submissions from three different exciting users, and we are going to talk about each one. But first, we have a little bit of site business, and that is happy birthday, Sarah D. Bunting.
Hey!
Thank you.
It is my alias here.
That's right. This is coming out a couple of days after Sarah's birthday, but still, shower her with belated birthday wishes when you hear this, because she deserves it.
Oh, thanks, guys.
All right. Speaking of Sarah D. Bunting, why don't you start us off? We each picked a canon entry from the buckets, and we'll start with Sarah's first. So take it away, Sarah.
We did. And I believe we each picked one. We all picked based on shows that had not been proposed at all for the canon, I think.
That's correct.
Is that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So I naturally selected Foyle's War because if I didn't, no one else would. This was brought to us by Dan Cassino, and I think he probably knew at least part of his audience. We will see. This is either Season 4, Part 2, Episode 2, or Season 4, Episode 4, or Season 5, Episode 2. It's called Casualties of War. You can find it on Amazon or iTunes. Dan Cassino, take it away.
Dear Dave, Tara, Sarah, and valued guests, if applicable, I am pleased to present for your consideration Foyle's War, Series 4, Episode 4, Casualties of War, for inclusion in the Extra Hot Great Canon. First, let's get the basics out of the way, since many listeners may have never seen the show. Foyle's War is without a doubt a series worthy of inclusion in the canon. Sure, it's from the genre of British people politely murdering each other and going away quietly once they're caught, but manages to transcend the genre by introducing some degree of moral complexity and overarching tension. In these shows, there's never really a question of whether the detective is going to catch the bad guy. We know there's going to be 3 to 5 suspects. 15 minutes before the end, the detective is going to have a flash of insight, and they're going to gather the suspects to tell us who did it. That formularity is what makes these shows comfort food, but Foyle's War tweaks the formula, and that's what makes it great. Like many of its peers, it's a period piece, given the opportunity for amazing 1940s outfits on everyone. But because it's set during the Second World War, we get that moral complexity. What's the point of solving individual murders when London is getting bombed on a nightly basis, when thousands are dying in battle, when the whole country might be invaded any time? Even Detective Chief Superintendent Christopher Foyle, a World War I veteran and our lead detective, thinks it's futile. The series starts with him asking to be transferred to a post where he can actually do some good for the war effort, but he's turned down because of his moral rigidity. He's doing something pointless, and he knows it, but he's going to keep on doing it anyway because that's his job. Albert Camus, eat your heart out. The World War II setting also means we get lots of History Channel bits designed to appeal to your uncle and possibly Dave, too. One episode hinges on the fact that Londoners would sleep in their cars in the countryside to avoid the Blitz. Another has a murder during the Dunkirk evacuation. The real tension in the show, and what puts it above its peers, is that once Foyle catches the miscreant, it's not clear if they're actually going to go away. Because sometimes, Foyle's superiors decide it would be bad for the war effort to actually punish the bad guy, so they cover up the whole thing. Much of Foyle's frustration. And it's in this episode that frustration finally boils over. So let's talk about this episode in particular. First, it has great British that guys. Mostly from Downton Abbey. General Madine from Return of the Jedi. That one guy from Chernobyl. Every bit part is filled out with someone who's in the footlights with Emma, and it shows. Moseley, who I'm never going to see as anything other than Moseley, in particular has a great turn as a husband who's pathetic and menacing in turn, right up until he gets murdered. Second, it's a great showcase for Honeysuckle Weeks, the amazingly named Honeysuckle Weeks, as Foyle's driver, Sam Stewart, who's generally just here to provide a dose of comic relief. In this one, she's working with the darkest theme of the episode, about the effect of the war on children. Not everyone gets evacuated to Narnia. Some kids just get traumatized, and there's not much anyone can do about it. Foyle's goddaughter, who he hasn't seen for 10 years, shows up out of the blue with a traumatized son, who sees his entire grade school class killed. Foyle's annoyed at the intrusion, but even if he wants to help, he has no idea what he's supposed to do about it. The kid is eventually foisted off into Sam. She tries to read comics with him, but they're all about the war. She's tried to buy him a toy, but in a scene aping Monty Python's cheese shop, everything in the shop is something about the war she's trying to help the kid escape. Clip one, please.
Well, if you don't mind my saying so, for a toy shop, we don't seem to have many toys.
Well, that's not my fault. All the toy factories have closed down or switched over to war production. You, as a mother, should know that.
Oh, I'm not his mother. I just don't want anything to do with the war. Have you any board games?
Yes, we have board games. Let's see. Submarine Hunt, Sky Battle, and Ocean War. All at two bob.
Now, the plotline seems like it's being played for laughs here, but the show takes the damage done to children seriously. As Foyle argues later in the episode, the teenagers who get caught up in the sabotage ring are only there because no one's watching them. Throughout the episode, the real victims of the war, and of the legal process, are the children. Third, it's got that good History Channel content. The main mystery centers on a murderer at a lab that's creating the dam buster bombs that prove vital to the war effort. But making them essentially skip across the water requires a rig that spins them at certain speeds where they're dropped, and it's all very complicated and, well, listen for yourself in clip two.
Now, on the face of it, the test was a complete fiasco. The wooden cladding shattered on impact.
As we predicted.
Yes, well, we don't gain any points for naysaying, Hans.
But the steel core held.
Yes.
Were they using our figures?
The backspin was 500 revs per minute. The package was dropped from 60 feet at 240 miles per hour.
But then it works.
It works. Tizard has persuaded the RAF to move ahead with a full-scale operational version.
That's wonderful.
Yes. But we're going to have to go over everything again. I mean, the pilots are going to have to go in so low that it's almost suicidal anyway. Plus the fact that they'll have almost 6,000 pounds of high explosives spinning in the middle of their fuselage. Now let's make sure that they don't blow up before they arrive.
Now, if that doesn't send you down a Google hole to try and find out how much of that was accurate, you've got a stronger will than I do. Of course, the main event is the mystery, and this one is structured beautifully. Foyle is investigating a sabotage ring that's been working its way up the coast. At the same time, the commissioner is forcing him to look into a traveling dice game. In seemingly unrelated threads, two teenage burglars are caught at gunpoint and forced to work for a mysterious foreigner. An out-of-work teacher, of course the kids aren't going to school anymore, thinks his wife is having an affair at work. Over the course of the episode, the threads come together perfectly, one helping resolve the other, with tiny inconsistencies coming together to solve everything. Even better, like all the episodes of Foyle, it's a fair mystery. Foyle never sees anything the viewers don't, and if you're clever enough, you can solve it along with him. This extends even to the swastika-based card game that all the characters try and solve throughout the show, which becomes completely obvious right after Foyle shows us how it's done. Now, once Foyle has solved the murder, that overarching tension kicks in. See, the sabotage ring is being overseen by a Spanish diplomat. They can't try him because of diplomatic immunity, but the authorities don't even want to expel him from the country. As far as they're concerned, the enemy they know is better than the one they don't, so they're letting him off scot-free, unlike the young men they've forced to carry out the sabotage. Foyle has figured out who killed Molesley. His wife, now without good reason, wanted him dead, arranged the whole thing, then covered it up. She killed her husband in cold blood, but she's important to the work of the lab, so she gets off as well. Of course, Foyle resists this, but he gets overruled in clip three.
I'm not asking you to close the book on this one, Foyle. No need of that. At the same time, I see no reason why Mrs. Richard shouldn't remain at liberty and at work while you tie up the loose ends.
Well, just two problems with that as far as I can see.
What are they?
Oh, well, firstly, we'd have to accept that she's in fact telling the truth.
She's confessed to the shooting. I don't see what possible explanation there could be.
Well, I can think of one or two. And we'd also have to accept that police procedure, British law, British justice are irrelevant if any odd uniform can turn up here and decide who can or can't be detained.
Look, I'm the one making the decisions here, Mr. Foyle. You can continue your investigation if you must, but I see no reason to keep Mrs. Richards behind bars.
But all of that happens with 15 minutes left in the episode. And the killers are actually celebrating having gotten away with it. Surely Foyle's going to figure out a way to bring them in. But he doesn't. His superiors even have leverage over him, the threat of prosecuting his goddaughter's attempted suicide. But they'll make that go away if Foyle just plays ball. Clip four, please.
It's not enough.
Right.
Well, it certainly is for me.
Foyle.
Now, with this sort of thing virtually condoned for the sake of the war effort, a man guilty of coercion and sabotage can't be touched, while two boys guilty of nothing more than slipping off the rails because of a lack of parental control will get several years with hard labor. Assistant commissioners doing their very best to undermine me in front of my staff. Yep, I'd say I'd had enough.
Look, I know you and I got off to a bad start, Foyle. It was my fault, and I apologize for it. But it's not too late. We can have another look at Mrs. Richards. And I'll tell you what. You know a young woman, Lydia Nicholson. I have here a report concerning an attempted suicide. A recommendation to prosecute. You see? Justice can sometimes be manipulated to help the individual.
Your justice, perhaps. Not mine.
Foyle understands that circumstances require that he bend his moral code, that he go along for the good of the war effort. But he can't do that, so he quits. This episode's got a clever mystery. It tackles an aspect of the war that's generally ignored. It makes sure to have some moments of lightness, has some good History Channel bits, a smarmy villain, and a card trick. Add in the catharsis of the conclusion, where Foyle finally tells off his superiors, and I hope it gets a deserved place in the Extra Hot Great Canon.
This is a tough case, because I like Foyle's War, and this is fairly typical of it in good ways and bad, but what I like about it is its wallpapery quality, that you can do and think about other things and kind of drift, and Foyle will wrap it up for you if you stop paying attention or fell asleep because you had a big dinner, say. This happened to a friend named Dan Brady, my husband. I don't know if that makes it a good canon debate, though, because it is kind of weak tea, and that's the appeal. But the other another problem is that it, because they're an hour and a half long, it does tend to remove the wanting to watch the next one criterion from consideration, at mm-hmm. least for me.
Yeah.
Because they're self-contained films, basically, and they, like this one excepted, they don't tend to cliffhang. And in this case, it's like, all right, well, this isn't the, you know, this right. isn't the finale. It kept going and they didn't rename it like Sam's War, so whatever. It was funny to me to see Molesley, because Dan and I did go through this phase where we were watching a lot of Brit procedurals. And he inevitably shows up. Like, it's just a matter of time mm-hmm. before Molesley shows up. Happy Valley, this one. What's it? The one with two names from the Lady Sally, help me.
Not Broadchurch.
No. Although he might have wandered through a scene in that too. Who knows? Anyway. It's Molesley.
Yeah.
He does what he needs to do. I think this was an excellent presentation. Dan Cassino, all of your points are well taken. I am quite fond of Foyle's War, but I think the very things that I value about it mean that it's probably never getting into the canon. Based on what Dave Cole called it in our Slack channel, I'm pretty sure he's not voting for it. Dave, would you like to talk about that? Wake up,
Do you want to go next or you want to go last?
I'll go last.
Yeah. Okay. I can certainly understand why people enjoy cozy mysteries. I don't know if this is like an accepted genre term or just what they call it on the Forever 35 podcast featuring past guest Dori Shafrir. I get why people like these. This is not for me. And even if you say A Murder, She Wrote is sort of a cozy mystery show, too, because even though someone gets murdered every time, it's no one that you know, really. If you watch the show every week, it's still, just someone that's parachuted in, someone who vaguely knows Jessica, whatever. It's comfortable. It's whatever. And as you said, Dan makes a lot of great points. I do like a period cop show. I think it's always interesting when writers can't fall back on, tech solutions to story problems. It always makes it more interesting. Right. The driver is very good. Honeysuckle Weeks is an amazing name for sure. And, you know, I'm not mad at the class critique inherent in the, you know, the diplomat escaping and the lackeys getting, you know, getting done. And also the grotesquerie of actually, you know, prosecuting or even threatening to prosecute an attempted suicide. Like, good Lord, what possible benefit could there be to anyone of going through with that, even if it is a crime on the books? Like, Jesus Christ. But, you know, even with all of that said, and as good as Mosley is as this fucking loser husband, where after he gets murdered, you're like, you know what? Good. Like, she's better off without him, honestly. Like, they do a good job in the early going establishing, like, he is a loser. He is dragging this woman down. He's gambling away all their money. You find out very late in the story that she's been cheating on him. And even then, you're like, you know what? Good. Because he's yeah, such an asshole.
Mostly.
Exactly. And I can certainly understand if you were a Foyle's War watcher that when you get to this climax at the end where he goes into this meeting and is like, this system is fucked up, but in his very dry Foyle's way. And you find out that he knew, of course, how it was going to go before it started and walked into it with his letter of resignation. Like, that's a boss move. And it's very cool when he just hands it over and is like, you know what? Fuck you. But again, in a very British period way. Mm-hmm. If you were watching to that point, I can understand why that would be an amazing moment. But, you know, if you've only ever watched this one, it doesn't have the impact. And even to compare this to another essentially procedural movie series, which we did when we considered Will Leach's presentation for Columbo, like, that one has a lot more zip than this did. Yeah. So as much as I treasured you, Dan Cassino, this one did not bust my dam, as it were. So I'm going to hand this over to David T. Cole to wrap it up.
Yeah, the name that I referred to this show in our Slack chat for the podcast was Foyle Snore, because this is boring. Foyle's boring. Foyle the character is boring.
I like Foyle. I will disagree with that, but yeah.
I kind of have a lead that's such a nothing. He's oatmeal. Oh, God. But guys, I just want to let you know something. Guys, the real casualty of war, it was justice.
Oh, it's not truth?
No.
Oh.
Sarah said about the lazy comfort quality of this. In my notes, I described the show as comfort food for Uncle Tank. Uh-huh. And Uncle Tank, as you know, is my recurring character who really enjoys World War II coffee
sure,
books.
Sure, yes.
That kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The military channel.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Never married.
Yep.
Loves World War II stuff. Can do you a day-by-day rundown of any battle that you wish. Mm-hmm. And this, I feel like, is maybe kind of the show for him. Mm-hmm. But in the same way that you may have that coffee table book in your house, it's something you browse. It's not something you consume. And I feel like that's the quality of this show. And I feel like it reaches that mark absolutely just perfectly peachy keen. I feel like if you want something that you can pay half attention to and then come back and figure out at the end what's going on, because Foyle does a like a wrap up every 15 minutes or yes. So explains everything again.
Yeah.
Have at it. I think that's fine. And that's a perfectly acceptable piece of entertainment. I just don't think that is canon worthy unto itself. And the show's not offering a lot beyond that. The mystery is serviceable, but nothing special in this day and age of your Luthers and your bonkers Scandinavian noir and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, it's hard to kind of get behind a quaint mystery for quaint mystery's sake.
But it's a different thing. You can't really compare this to Luther. This is for an entirely different audience.
I agree. I'm just saying,
yeah,
to back up your point, it's got no zip.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why.
I will say one thing I forgot to mention in my rundown was that the kid they hired to play James.
Oh my God.
He had the most amazing fuck you glares in a prepubescent child I think I've ever seen.
I went on a roller coaster with James.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about his quintessential mouthful of British graveyard teeth. Holy shit. Frost teeth.
I started off absolutely hating him and wanting somebody to throw him in the river. You know, I'm very sorry for the character that he had to witness his whole classroom die in a bombing, but watching a zombified kid not react to anything that happens for in half an hour in the show, I don't want to see that character anymore on the show. But then he finally kind of comes around to being quasi-reactive, and the way he reacts is just eye-rolling everything in the universe. Yeah. And it's sort of like, you know, he's kind of Queenie, right? You know?
Yeah.
Like
in he's very dramatic in his facial expressions.
And so I went from hating him to my favorite thing about this episode.
Yeah.
The character of Sam, who is Honeysuckle Weeks' character, I just want to point out that her full name, according to Wikipedia, is Honeysuckle Hero Susan Weeks.
Nice.
Yep. Susan. Why fuck it up?
You don't want to get too crazy. You got to throw a Susan in there. Maybe her mother was lazy. I don't know. Her sister is New Higgins on New Magnum.
Right. Shiggins, as I said when we were watching this yesterday.
So, perfectly serviceable. The one just script note I had is there's this ongoing throughput about Sam trying to amuse James during his mute phase. And one of the things she tries to do is get him to play card games. And there's like this card, one of those giant, like second edition Hoyle's rules of cards and all the different games you can play. And one of them is this Make the Swastika game, where it's like, you imagine a square, you build a square of cards, and then you have four cards you can place within the middle of it. And you have to create a swastika with those four cards. And it's during World War II, and nobody in the show's like, yeah, I know we're having fun with swastikas, but guys, do you hate the Nazis? Doesn't happen. Everybody's just like, got to make that swastika. It's like, it was just a weird omission.
Look, a puzzle is a puzzle, man.
Well, she also is like, when she's pointing out that she's been in like three explosions in the last 2 years or whatever, yeah. And she's like, and Jerry bombed my house. Like, they'll just use these shitty terms that, yeah. I mean, I guess they earned it.
On a final note on the Dam Busters, there was a video game for ColecoVision in the Commodore 64 I played called The Dam Busters. Mm-hmm. And it was the most frustrating video game I played as a child ever, because it was like, because when you hear it, you're like, the Dam Busters, you're in this giant bomber and you got to fly over Germany and bomb this dam. Ooh, sounds fun. I'm into it. It was like this sim shit thing where like it almost happened in real time. So you would take off from England, fly over the channel, fly over France, be subject to anti-air fire. Then you would have to like jump in the gunner seat and shoot out the lights. And there's like all these various things that would happen on your way to having to blow up, I think, one of three dams. Like sure. It literally would take half an hour to get there, it seemed. And there's all these like dials you had to keep, like, you're a kid. I don't want to have to deal with air flaps and airspeed and headwinds and what? Yes, question.
Did you decide to vote against this episode as soon as you saw they were working on Dam Buster technology, because you maintain resentment against Dam Busters because of this game to this day?
I share the Dam Buster bomb creator's frustration with the process, because the process of blowing up a dam was equally frustrating. So you're flying into Germany and you had to do it as they described. You had to fly very low towards the dam and then the absolute pinpoint part, drop your bomb so it'll skip over the water and smack the dam and blow it up.
Right.
If you fucked up in any way, and there was like all these variables you had to get just right. Keep in mind, I'm like 7, 8, I don't know, something like that. It's just like, well, you fucked that up. Back to England with you to start again. Ah, fuck. That was half an hour ago. The Dam Busters. Fuck you. Acclaim for making the Dam Busters.
It's almost like 7-year-olds shouldn't be busting dams.
Mm-hmm. So in conclusion, Foils War, whatever season this actually you decided it is, whatever episode you decide this is, Casualty of Wars, perfectly serviceable, but I would say a far distance away from canon material.
Yeah.
Let us put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Tank Bunting. First of all, I would like to say the name of the series that I was groping for is Scott and Bailey. I don't know why I have a mental block on that name.
Yes.
I really liked that show. I also really like Dan Casino, and I really like Foils War, but this is a no for me, dog.
All right, Arianna.
I vote no as well, but you know, we love you, Dan. Please submit again. Don't let this stop you.
I forgot to talk about the terrible Spanish ambassador acting,
too. Oh, yeah. He's
well,
not great.
If you watch it, enjoy that guy, because he's in a totally different show from everybody else.
He is chewing.
Oh, boy, is he ever. Yep. So that means with my no vote, I'm sorry to report that Foils War season 4/series 4/season 5/episode 4 or 2, depending on how you want to play things, casualties of war, you are hereby not inducted into the extra.
Moving on, I selected from the list The Haunting of Hill House, Season 1, Episode 6, an episode titled Two Storms. This comes from our Francais ami, Francaise, Caroline. Whee! And I picked this from the list for a couple of reasons. One is that I actually watched all of this season when it first came out. I believe I talked about it in Around the Dial at the time. And the second reason is that it stars Timothy Hutton. And for reasons that we talked about a couple of weeks ago in Winners and Losers, probably no one is going to be picking a Timothy Hutton joint off of any list anytime soon because his career is D-E-A-D, as dead as the
Please don't say Timothy Hutton and joint in the same sentence anymore.
Yeah, sorry. Anyway, that was the reason. I figured let's get this out the door. Let's talk about Timothy Hutton this one time and then never again. So let us throw this to Caroline to tell us why we should induct The Haunting of Hill House, Season 1, Episode 6, Two Storms.
Hello, my name is Caroline. I would like to submit to the canon The Haunting of Hill House, Episode 6, The Two Storms. The Haunting of Hill House tells the story of the Crane family, who moved into what turned out to be a haunted mansion in the summer of 1992, and were afflicted by horrific tragedy and supernatural hauntings. It's been one of my favorite Netflix original series, which is weird, because I'm not a horror person at all. I hesitated with episode 5, The Bent Neck Lady, which focuses on Nell. People are deeply touched by the last 10 minutes when we realize to what extent the character was doomed from the start. But I find this episode is stronger as a whole in terms of acting, directing, and writing. It reminds me of the canonized episode of Buffy the Body, as both deal with human grief and make it real, despite the supernatural setting. Like in Buffy, there's hardly any music, except at the very end. Now, it's 15 minutes before we even go to the haunted house, as we see the family reunited for the first time at Shirley's funeral home for Nell's wake. I like the adult brothers looking like two little kids in front of the casket, and Steve's panicked reaction when he sees his sister's dead body. It's 15 minutes at the same place, but it's not static. It doesn't read like a play, thanks to the excellent direction, which is very fluid, with panning camera shots. For example, the camera goes round, showing Nell all alone in her coffin in an empty room, while the family gathers in the atrium. Again, when Hugh, the father, sees his children as kids, then after another spin, they're back as adults. A trick used again when he sees Nell in her coffin. This passage shows well the awkwardness of the situation, especially with relatives you hardly see anymore. And it builds the tension well as old resentments and new ones are brought up. It's particularly good at describing mourning someone who just committed suicide. For example, the helplessness of a father who has to face his own inability to protect his kids. The anger we can feel because of the implied selfishness of the act, but also finger-pointing, trying to find someone to blame, etc. Now, at the Haunted Manor, the real star of the series is the house. It's a gothic, gloomy, gorgeous monster. It should be said that this is a series that is even more enjoyable on a second viewing to appreciate the beauty of the place and the ghosts playing hide-and-seek in the corners. My only issue with this episode is that we don't spend nearly enough time in the house. The first and second episodes linger longer in every room, but in terms of storytelling, this one seems more compelling to me. I particularly love the twins. I'm usually against cute Muppet-type kids, but really the casting here is great. My personal kryptonite is Luke, played by Julian Hilliard, the little boy with the thick glasses. He melts my cold heart. I mean, when Luke finds his sister and tells her never to disappear on him again, it's just too much for me. I also like the scene where Hugh keeps chasing what turns out to be apparitions of his wife, because it shows that for all intents and purposes, she's already a ghost. The house has already claimed her as such. Now, the metaphors. Some are very heavy-handed, but others are quite efficient to my mind. So let's start with the expressionism. The weather mirrors the grief and distraction they feel inside. Storms within and storms without. Nothing new here. Things are falling apart in this episode. The mother, Olivia's psyche, is fractured by this point, just like the chandelier. It's not subtle, but I think it's well done. My favorite aspect of the metaphors is Nell's disappearance. To me, this is a great idea. The great shot of everybody following the dad to watch Nell in her coffin, not realizing that her ghost is right behind them, which is a theme in Nell's life and now in her death. It's not ostentatious. It's not there to create scares, just to make a point. In the flashback, Nell suddenly becomes invisible to her family. I find this idea very compelling. It's very human to feel ignored or invisible to the people who are supposed to be close to us. Even her scary ghost form goes unnoticed. I know that to horror connoisseurs such as yourselves, this may seem underwhelming in the scare department, but to me, this is better than gore or cheap thrills because it uses this trope to tell a really human story. For all this ideas, I hope you will consider this episode for your canon.
All right, I'll go first. I was interested to hear what kind of case Caroline made for this, and thank you for that. And watching it for the first time since I watched it when it first came out, I was surprised that the taken out of the context of the rest of the season, this one actually, I thought, stood up in a very economical and effective way, doling out the backstory as all of the characters arrive. It comes out pretty organically what their relations are to each other and, you know, the state of where they are and what's happened to them and blah, blah, blah. I thought this was, you know, if you started here weirdly, that it would still make sense. You would get it. And the style choices that they make, I think, are interesting. The continuous swirling shots that she mentioned and how the lights darken very, 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 very slowly in a way that you don't notice until they brighten again. Yeah. It's like that you think you're going crazy at first because I was taking notes on my phone and we were watching with the light off so we wouldn't get the glare on the screen from the lamp. I thought it was just like my eyes adjusting from my phone to the screen. And then it was like, oh, no, that's for real.
I had a note that was like, why is this funeral home so dimly lit?
Yeah.
I know they're not.
Yeah, so did I.
Lit up like ballparks. Right. But I was like, this seems darker. Yeah. And then suddenly it was like,
the lights come back up. Yeah. Also a good call to pick an episode where there's not a ton of Theo because she is the least well-drawn character. Yeah, I mean, it does some things well. I think the introduction of Hugh, who is, you know, still haunted, obviously, by his wife, who he keeps talking to that no one else can see. And when he walks around a corner looking for the bathroom and back into the house and into his memories, I mean, I think that's well done. Although once they get there and it's in the middle of a storm and it's obviously cold and everyone is walking around with bare feet, I was upset. Go put socks on. Actually, go put shoes on. Windows are being blown out, you dummies. But the problem with this show, and in this episode especially, is that the dialogue can be very stagey.
Extremely stagey.
Yeah.
Positioning and everything was very, like, I could see this happening mm-hmm. at some small New York stage somewhere.
Yeah, and even the production design, like, we complained back when we talked about House of Cards about how every set looked the same. It had the same kind of like bland
gray green
tastefulness, and it's the same at the funeral home where everything is seafoam green except Nell's dress is red. Like, we get it. And all of the, you know, when we later on when we go from the mansion back to the funeral home, all of the family like sitting in rows like they're on a bus, like we already know they are disconnected. Like, we get it. But even so, you know, I do think some of the way that they use ghosts in some of the episodes is more subtle than others. This, as she said, I think is one of the subtler ones, believe it or not. Like when you get, when you're in the mansion and you see like a statue, will, its head will turn that you, you know, unless you're really paying attention, you don't necessarily notice it. Or at the funeral home where Nell's ghost is there and then it's not and stuff, like it's not, they don't always shine a light, as it were, on the way they're using ghostly moments. And even so, you know, she mentioned that she considered episode 5. And I told Dave after we finished this one, if I were going to pick one, that would be the one that I picked. And that was the one where when I got to the end of it, it was like, that should have been the series, the season finale. And I still feel that way. So I don't think this is the worst episode, but I don't think it's the strongest either. But having been, as the only one of the three of us who watched the whole season, I'm really curious to know what you think, especially you, Sarah, our ghost fan. So why don't you go next?
Yeah. This is not for me at all.
Okay.
At all. It's not just Reaser, and it's not just Turk 1 Rapey 2. So shit does not help. Well,
I'm sorry. Did you just make a one, Turk 182 rape joke?
Yes, yeah, she did.
Right. Yes, allegedly. Sorry. I'm not sorry. Fuck him. I did want to like this and engage with it. There's actors in it I like. I was interested by the casting choices, like Henry Thomas to Hutton is good casting. But there were just too many things. Like Reaser actually was fine here.
Yeah, this was the show that made me like her for the very first time, yeah. Actually.
But this is like, and you know, I've read the book a couple of times, and that this is kind of like, except for haunting and a house, there's like basically no relationship. Like, sure. And I wonder if I had watched it before, and if I did watch it from the beginning, like, Caroline's comment about it not being like a really sort of jump scary proposition just made me think about, as you get older, you realize that, first of all, ghosts are not for ghosts. Like, legend always casts the ghost as having a mission to carry out with our help, but really they're there for our benefit, not right. The other way around, I think. And also at how much good horror is about grief.
Yeah.
Like The Babadook, which I'm never watching again, but man, did that absolutely nail that part of it, that sort of tension between being terrified and being furious, and being just, you know, turned inside out by despair. So I feel like this show is trying to get at a lot of those things and stay away from horror cliches. But in the process, it's doing some poetics button mashing that I didn't care for. And Michel Huisman is a disastrous in this part. Sorry. Like the "you're the ghost, you are dad" line reading. I was like, where is it? Come on. Forget you, dad. Like, oh, God. And everyone's just sort of planting feet in these various dyads to scream at each other about taking or not taking or totally secretly taking his character's money. And I'm like, I mean,
the screaming family member dialogue, it felt like it was taking from like an intervention meeting.
Yeah.
And then put on stage.
"You're taking his money has impacted me in the following ways."
Right. Yeah,
exactly. Right.
"Here is my bottom line with his money." Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I think that this show, I don't think anyone is like wrong for enjoying it or liking it or having mixed feelings about it or wherever you land on it. But I'm all set. Like, this is not going to do anything but irritate me, I have a feeling. Excellent presentation as always, but this is a pass for me. Dave.
I don't have that much else to say that you guys didn't. The big thing for me is how stagey it is and how then because of how stagey it was, how unreal and not unreal in a good ghost mystery way, just uncanny valley everybody seemed as, in relation to real people that would be experiencing this. There is a time and place for showy, stagey productions. It can work. I don't really think it works here. And when you double that with that dialogue that was just so proud of itself.
It's the first thing they teach you in Big Brother school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. I just could not get on board with what they were doing. And I felt like some of that feelings were actually, some of those differences were magnified by.
There you go.
Thank you very much. I'm editing all that out, but I'm leaving the part that I said I'm editing it all that in. What happened? You'll never know. I felt the camera work, such as the twirling around everybody, hurt it, actually. It was supposed to be this, not meditative, but this sort of this contemplative moment for everybody in this, in the, what do you call that? It's not a waiting room, whatever, the dead body presentation room in the funeral home. I felt it was just like, it felt like something, like they should have been in Times Square with that thing zooming around. It was like too fast and like didn't really work, just felt very showy and sort of contributed to that stagey feel in a way, or at least that look at me, what a production sort of way that took away from the ghost story elements of it.
Right.
And the ghost story, I feel like they kind of split the difference between, you know, a ghost story and the haunting of the soul sort of story. And Pick One maybe would be a stronger show, but it just kind of felt like, eh. Some of the visuals were kind of neat, you know, with the mother running down the hallway that ended. But then why was that hallway there? There's like a little nook of hallway that has no doors. It just ends. It's like 6 feet of nothing.
Well, sometimes there's a door there and sometimes there isn't.
Oh, okay.
Spoiler.
Okay. All right. Well, then it's in. Canon
I'm just saying, like, that's part of the hauntingness. Okay. Right. Like, that's a secret door that, you know, only some people can see it. Sometimes
I wasn't scared. I didn't sympathize or empathize with anybody. And if I'm not either of those things, I don't think it was an effective episode. So shall we put this to the vote?
Yeah.
Tara Ariana?
Yeah, I vote nay. I mean, I think when we did an Extra Extra Hot Great recently about shows that could have been movies, this was my pick and I stand by that.
What wasn't it? Didn't they make like two movies out of the story?
There's another season coming.
No, but didn't they make two movies out of the story in like in 1 year? Was it because there's a Liam Neeson movie?
Yes. This could have been a movie and should have been. Yeah. It was. Yes, I mean, but this cast, I'm saying this version of it really, really drags, and this is not the best example to argue against my feeling that it drags. So sorry, but it's a no vote for me.
Okay, Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah, it's a no for me. Sorry.
I'm also going to say no. So that means, unfortunately, The Haunting of Hill House, Season 1, Episode 6. Two Storms. You are hereby not inducted into the Extra Hungry Camp. All right, it's time for our third submission. It is Baskets, Season 1, Episode 4, Easter in Bakersfield. Here we go.
Hi, this is Jeff, and I'm submitting Season 1, Episode 4 of Baskets, entitled Easter in Bakersfield, for the Extra Hot Great Canon. To set the scene, since nobody but me watches this show, Chip Baskets, played by Zach Galifianakis, has dropped out of clown school in France and returned home to Bakersfield, California, where he moves in with his mother, Christine, played by the deservedly Emmy-winning Louis Anderson, and finds work as a rodeo clown. He's brought with him a French wife who insists on her own apartment and has openly only married him to get to America, and rounding out the crew are Chip's twin brother Dale, arrogant owner of a failing bullshit career college, major scare quotes, also played by Galifianakis, and his Costco insurance adjuster and friend, although he would never refer to her as that, Martha. The episode opens with Chip having Easter drinks with the owner of the rodeo, where he overhears his wife, who generally avoids him at all costs, singing TLC's Waterfalls at karaoke. We cut to the next morning, where Christine wakes him to go to Easter Sunday church service. On the drive to pick up Christine's mother, Meemaw, they fight over the radio. A clip would not lend itself to a podcast, but suffice it to say that Louis Anderson's facial expressions alone could have been his whole Emmy reel. Chip, of course, embarrasses his whole family at church in a near wordless scene that, even if you've never seen the show, beautifully lays out the family dynamics. Post-church, Christine catches up with an old friend who asks after her other adopted set of twins and, of course, wants to know about the prodigal Chip. Here, Louis Anderson perfectly plays the combination of Christine's disappointment alongside her need to defend her family at all passive-aggressive costs.
You know, the adopted twins are doing quite well.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is it they do again?
DJs. Very successful. Flew first class last year.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And how's Chip?
Oh, Chippy, he's a trooper. We love him. He's a free spirit, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. My Dana said she saw him chasing a bull down at the rodeo.
Dana?
Yeah.
I think I saw her at Kmart, messed out of her gourd.
Oh, mm-hmm. No. Well, Dana did have a problem with prescription medication, but mm-hmm. She is just fine now.
Oh, well, that's mm-hmm. good, because yeah. I felt bad for you. Maybe it's the way she's wearing her hair.
You're missing the way she absolutely houses a chocolate-covered Rice Krispie treat after, but as a fellow food self-medicator, trust me that it's perfect. After church, it's time for Easter brunch at the casino. Here they run into Martha with her parents. I had to clip this not only because it highlights Martha Kelly's understated performance, but also because the flat, "Hi, Mrs. Baskets," has become a constant refrain in my household.
Chip. Martha, isn't that Martha? Isn't that Martha?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi. Martha!
Shh!
Hi, Mrs. Baskets.
Hi.
Hi, Chip.
Christine, of course, insists that the two families sit together, incorrectly sensing sexual tension between Chip and Martha. When Chip goes to get his omelet, we also see one of the main sources of comedy in this show, Chip's complete inability to function in the real world when faced with the small, banal niceties of suburban life.
I can get you a cheese omelet, a ham omelet, probably some bacon in there. I can get you huevos rancheros. That'll be cool.
That sounds good.
I like your ponytail. My sister has a ponytail.
Does she?
Yeah. I was thinking about getting one, but I might look like my sister. You know what I mean?
About what?
I don't know.
Can you just make my omelet, please?
Yeah. And here is your spicy medium. Here you go.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Cold pepper's coming through.
Tensions rise between Christine and Chip, he trying to run off to avoid his family, listen to French lessons, and smoke, and she trying to keep up appearances and have an outwardly perfect family life. After Chip storms off, we hear shades of Christine's own cutting remarks from Meemaw and see how she's learned to deal with her own issues.
I'm really sorry. He didn't get enough sleep last night.
That's what you've been saying since he was a little baby. Mm-hmm. Jumps out of the playpen and you say he needs sleep.
But it's true. You have to get enough sleep. You really do.
Do you know what will help all this?
What?
Let's get a dessert.
Again, as a stress eater, I see you, Christine. Meanwhile, Chip has escaped to the smoke-friendly casino where a dealer lights his cigarette, the first person this episode to truly understand him. Back at brunch, Meemaw is publicly raking Christine over the coals for her food issues, driving her away as well.
It started when she was a teenager. I would find these candy wrappers and what have you in her backpack.
Mother.
And when she was a freshman, she was poised to be the head of her cheerleading squad. But by the time she reached her junior year, that just went out the window.
I sprained my ankle.
Why do you think you sprained your ankle? It was all that new excess fat she had on her. I did everything I could. I made her write down everything she ate. We had weigh-in Wednesdays, but somehow she was always able to get it. So that's why after a while I just gave up. I mean, she was so sensitive about it, and it was really, really sad because cheerleading meant everything to her.
That's so sad.
Well, eventually she had to settle for that husband of hers. He was a piece of work. Then she just funneled all of her energy into motherhood, and you see how well that turned out. So the sugar just kept coming. Christine, sit down, honey. Eat your desserts.
She ends up at the slot machine next to Chip, where he offers her the candy he knows will make her feel better, being the first person in this episode to truly understand her. The two have the closest they can to a heart-to-heart, with Christine finally feeling seen and Chip admitting that his life is in disarray. After three episodes exploring their difficult, fraught relationship, this episode sweetly closes out with the two silently playing slots side by side until Christine breaks it with the only appropriate response to someone else's joy at a big win.
Shut up!
As someone who is extremely hot and cold on Zach Galifianakis, I was ready to skip Baskets completely until I read a few warm reviews, one of which mentioned that Samuel D. Hunter had written two episodes of the first season. For those who don't know, meaning everyone, Samuel D. Hunter is a MacArthur Genius Grant winning playwright and my favorite playwright on the planet. I knew I would have to watch at least through his episodes, the first of which is Eastern Bakersfield. In the past, I've described his writing aesthetic as damaged people trying and failing to connect in our broken world. Baskets as a show, and this episode specifically, have this in spades. I'll admit that I was hooked from episode one with the perfect combination of humor, pathos, and satire of American culture, or lack thereof, but this episode was the first to really get the show firing on all cylinders and start exploring what damaged these people and why they struggle so much to reach out to each other. Bolstered by truly exceptional performances, especially from Louis Anderson, I believe Eastern Bakersfield shows Baskets at its best and belongs in the extra hot great canon.
Thank you, Jeff. What an amazing presentation.
Yeah,
that was super fun.
So good.
Yeah, loved it.
I'll start off since this was my pick. How the fuck is this the best, most pleasant surprise out of these three shows?
I know.
Going into it, I picked, we each picked, and I was last, and there's nothing in the bucket that I was like, what? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I was ooh, I meant to catch that.
And yes.
Well, I know about Baskets. I think I watched the premiere once upon a time, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, fine. And then we watched it. And then, how the hell is Louis Anderson playing Mother so good? And, you forget about it in 2 seconds.
And it's Louis. Won an Emmy for this season and was nominated 2 more times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I like comedies / dramedies with a mean streak or edge to them. Mm-hmm. So this worked for me in that context. And about this episode in particular, I feel like I can keep watching from this episode and I understand everything that's going on mm-hmm. in this world,
yeah.
maybe with the exception of knowing that the karaoke singer was his wife.
Right.
It's not actually in dialogue in this episode. But once you know that, start with this episode, I guess, I think would be fine. If this is the one where it finally hit on all cylinders, I think it gives you enough of everybody's character that you know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little like White Atlanta sometimes,
mm-hmm.
with all our non-problems, in place of real problems.
Sure.
I don't remember for sure that I watched the premiere, but
I watched it. I didn't remember that you watched
okay,
it.
Okay, well, whatever it is, my problem with Zach Galifianakis post stand-up is this. His energy in stand-up was sort of like an electric car. It moves and then it brakes and stops, but the brakes and stops is where he's recharging the act, right?
Right.
That was sort of his rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like da-da-da-da-da-da, withering stare.
Musical break. Right.
And the show kind of has that same rhythm as it goes to comedy and the pathetic moments. And I think maybe I didn't react to that at first because it was sort of like, can we just keep the car moving? But then once you see the rhythm of it, that it is sweet and sour, and it has to be that way because you wouldn't take the sour if you didn't have those comedic moments, the guy with the quickest, laziest omelet making in the world and him just pouting, stomping off, saying cold peppers coming through. It was so funny.
Yeah.
And then you take that with some very damaged people that are trying their best not to wear that face in the world, pretty much everybody mm-hmm. in this show. It works. It's got a really great balance. And I feel kind of bad that I didn't give this show a fair shake when it came out. Did I really? Not sure. But I enjoyed what they had on offer here. And I would say, let's keep watching.
And I was going to say, now we have 4 seasons to watch and time to watch them. Shall I go next?
I will say the mm-hmm. one thing they gave me pause about this episode is, and hopefully it's something they bailed on. I don't need all these France flashbacks with Sad Clown Dude.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, if the dynamic of this show is the contrast between Chip's total idiocy / goonishness versus Christine's, white-knuckled attempt to hold on to her dignity, there's First of all, that's a great premise for a show. Second, there's kind of no better showcase for that tension than Easter. It's like one of the lesser holidays, which really only exists for like keeping up appearances, you know, church-wise. It doesn't have all of the fraught, you know, pageantry of Christmas, but there certainly are still like expectations of a certain group of people. And, you know, Chip is not meeting them because he's a fuck up. And I'm so glad that Jeff called out the scene where Christine reads this woman that's like trying to passive aggress her by passive aggressing back about the pillhead who saw him, like whatever.
And framing it as, I felt so bad for you.
For you. Yeah. I mean, it's just brilliant. Like, these are the barbs. Like, it's stuff like that that makes the show better than you think it's going to be when you hear Louis Anderson is playing his mother, because like that's so sharply observed and smart. And similarly, you know, at the end, the other thing that Jeff called out, which is Meemaw telling, you know, that horrible story about Christine gaining weight in high school. And it, you know, reminds me of what I talked about when I mentioned Shrill and Around the Dial, how, you know, that was also very sharply observed about mothers and daughters and, you know, how society makes it impossible for, you know, women not to pass on their own neuroses about that to their daughters, and what a horrible cycle it is. Like, you know, Meemaw's got her own shit, and maybe there's an episode about that that we haven't gotten to yet, but like that doesn't make it any less painful to Christine in the moment. Even when the response that Meemaw gets backing her up is from like Martha's senile mother just repeating the last thing that she heard because she has no idea what's going on, it seems. The only knock I would have on this is that Martha was one of my favorite things about the one episode we did watch. I love Martha Kelly, so I wish there was more of her in this episode, and her deadpan energy is like a really good leavening for everything that's going on. But yeah, I agree with Dave. This is a great show. I'm excited to pick back up and continue watching. So, Jeff, thank you so much. Sarah.
It took this a few minutes to get me because I was like, oh, right. And Louis Anderson is the mom. Like, ugh, cool. Stunt cringe comedy. not for Buncee at all. But there is something so lived in about Zach Galifianakis's, I'm never going to get that name right. like his heavy sadness, like his clothes just look like they weigh a ton. He's so beaten down. I did love that scene. Like, they start out by drinking, what is it called? Bunny juice?
Yeah.
Which is like the Easter-themed cocktail, which has like a bunny-shaped marshmallow peep, like jammed really uncomfortably into the side. And Chip is just like, okay. Like, it looks vile. It looks disgusting. It's like the kind of horrible Sunday, like over the top Sunday a 9-year-old would order at Friendly's, talking of course about myself. And then he hears this extremely Nico and the Velvet Underground performance from this, like, we don't know that's his wife, but that didn't matter because that reference, and then cut to him just hung over on his floor, like perfectly done. It's shot to suggest the kind of chewed at the corners existence that they're all living. And Louis Anderson in that scene where Meemaw is putting Christine's like food issues on blast and herself as well at the same time. It's really good. Like, there's just this like aggrievedness to it that it, for some reason, really works. I like, maybe if this were more dramedy in terms of the format and the length, it would not work, but at 21 odd minutes it was perfect. It was real tart, but it was interesting. I did want to watch more of it, and I absolutely thought that this was going to be my hell no of these. So like, points for the element of surprise as well.
All right, let's put it to the official vote. I say yes, Tara.
I do too.
Sarah?
Me three.
Phew, I'm glad we got one. All right, Baskets, Season 1, Episode 4, Easter in Bakersfield. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon. Hey, speaking about surprises and winning things, you know what time it is? Surprise game time!
Jeez.
All right, this is a non-regulation game time, and I'm springing it on them. They did not know it was coming, so I'm pretty sure they didn't cheat this time. Today, we are playing German to the Situation from Raymond C., who earns himself an extra credit. He writes, when an American TV show airs in Germany, sometimes they change the title. In this game, I will give you the German title translated back in English, and I will also give you the American network and the air dates.
Oh, okay,
so
great.
Get all that info, okay. And you just guess the show title. No other hints. You either get it or you don't. 1 point apiece. So here's an example.
Okay.
The German title when translated into English is Spaceship Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And it was originally ran in the U.S. on NBC from 66 to 69. It is
Star Trek.
That was a very easy one. But that is how the game is played. No steel mills playing today. But whoever loses today misses out on two bonus steel mills that everybody else is going to get.
Hey, good one.
Okay.
The value guests. So
nice.
With that, let's throw it to Pinky to see who will be starting today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. We'll start with Sarah. No equalizer zones either today. We have 30 dramas, 20 comedies in play.
Ooh.
Are we ready to play German to the Situation?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Here we go. Sarah DeBunting, your show, 1,000 Miles of Dust, aired on CBS from 1959 to 1966. We're starting with dramas.
1,000 Miles of Dust?
Mm-hmm.
Gunsmoke.
You're in the wheelhouse. Rawhide.
Bonanza.
Rawhide.
What's the matter? You don't like Bonanza?
On the Run. ABC 63 to 67.
It's not The Fugitive, so I don't know.
The Fugitive.
Oh, fuck. I didn't think it was that early. Shit.
Sarah D. Bunting. Continuing with dramas, Makeup and Pistols, NBC 74 to 78.
Makeup and Pistols.
Yes.
Petticoat Junction?
Is that Charlie's Angels?
Policewoman.
Oh!
Oh, Jesus.
Tara?
Yep.
Our Little Farm, NBC 74 to 83.
Little House on the Prairie.
That's our first correct answer.
Phew.
Sarah,
Jesus.
The Hard-Hitting Five, ABC, 75 to 76.
The Hard-Hitting Five. White Shadow?
That's SWAT.
Oh.
Tara.
Yep.
The $7 Million Woman, ABC, 76, all the way to NBC on 78. Switch numbers.
Is it The Bionic Woman?
It is. Sarah D. Bunting, A Duke Rarely Comes Alone, CBS 79 to 85.
Long running.
Dukes of Hazzard.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Harsh But Friendly, ABC 79 to 84.
Harsh But Friendly.
Harsh But Friendly.
What network?
ABC. 79-84. I wish we had somebody who spoke German right here that they could scream the real titles and then I would turn.
Yeah. Shit. God, I don't know. Chips.
Heart to Heart.
Oh, of course.
Sarah D. Bunting, continuing with our dramas. The Denver Clan. ABC 81 all the way to 89.
The Denver Clan. Well, when in doubt, Dynasty.
That's the one. The only show ever set in Denver.
Except Mork and Mindy.
That's Boulder.
Yeah. And also not a drama. Yeah.
Same diff.
Tara?
Yes.
Chief Dr. Westfall.
That's St. Elsewhere.
All right.
Okay. Sorry.
No problem. Sarah D. Bunting. The Female Agent with a Heart, CBS 83-87.
The Female Agent with a Heart.
Yes.
Ben Sona.
That is Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
Oh, okay.
Tara.
Yep.
The Extraterrestrial Visitors Come, NBC 84-85.
Oh, only 1 year. That doesn't help me.
The Extraterrestrial Visitors Come.
Misfits of Science. Not it.
Keyword there is visitors.
Oh, V.
V, correct.
Shit.
Sarah D. Bunting, An Angel on Earth, NBC 84-89.
Highway to Heaven?
Nice.
Oh!
Da-da-da-da, Tara.
Yep.
The Model and the Private Eye, ABC 85-89.
Remington's. Oh, shit! Oh, it's one of two. What network again?
ABC 85-89.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh. Remington Steele.
Out of curiosity, what was the other one?
Moonlighting.
Moonlighting.
Damn it.
Oh.
All right, Sarah, this is everybody's last question before our first score break. Sarah D. Bunting, Murder is Her Hobby. CBS 84-96.
Murder, She Wrote?
Correct.
Yay. Tara,
yes.
The Best Years, ABC 1987-1991.
Wonder Years. No?
Incorrect. 30-something.
Oh, sure, of course.
Oh.
All right. Scores, please, Tara.
Very close game. I have 3 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 4 points.
All right, let's get right back to it. Continuing with drama, Sarah D. Bunting, this is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
The Fight Against the Mafia. CBS 87-1990.
Crime Story.
Crime Story was NBC, as I recall.
Oh.
The Miami Vice guy had a deal or
something. Right.
This is Wise Guy.
Oh, fuck.
Wise Guy.
Tara.
Mm hmm.
Jake and McCabe through thick and thin.
Jake and the Fat Man.
All right. Sarah, this is question. Is Everything Okay, Corky? ABC 89-93.
Shit, what was that called? Life Goes On?
Life Goes On, correct. Tara?
Yep.
The Lifeguards from Malibu, NBC 89-90.
Baywatch.
Wait, it was only on for this original?
I think after that it was unsyndicated.
Oh, syndicated after that. Okay.
Yeah, Baywatch.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting, Back to the Past, NBC 89-93.
Back to the Past?
Yeah. Correct.
NBC Back to the Past. American Dream. That's wrong.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
Oh.
Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap.
Oh.
Tara.
Yes.
Alaska of all places. CBS 1990-1995.
That's a great title. Northern Exposure.
Good job, Vicky.
Sarah D. Bunting, Palm Beach Duo, CBS 91-93, and USA 93-99.
Mm.
Silk Stockings?
One for your dad.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yeah.
The Creepy Cases of the FBI, Fox 93-2002.
The X-Files.
Sarah, Welcome to Life, ABC 94-95.
Oh, my so-called life.
Tara. Once More with Feeling, ABC 99-2002.
Oh, no. ABC.
Yeah. Got the mustard.
3 years. Sports Night. Not the correct answer, but it's what I said.
Once and Again.
Oh.
Billy Campbell.
All right, back to Sarah. A Mountie in Chicago, CBS 94-96.
A Mountie in Chicago?
Uh-huh.
Due South?
Correct. Tara.
Yep.
Cool.
Welcome, Mrs. President, ABC 2005 to 2006.
Oh, no. What was that called? Commander in Chief? Okay.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Yep.
Everything Betty! ABC 2006 to 2010. Everything Betty! Exclamation point.
Everything Betty?
Yes, on the American Broadcasting Company? Corporation? 2006, 2010.
Ugly Betty?
Nice.
Tara, this is our last drama, and okay. Take us into our second score break.
Alrighty.
Seattle Firefighters, The Young Heroes, ABC, 2018 to the present.
Station 19.
Station 19 is correct. And it's time for the scores again.
Well, guess what, Dave?
Is it tied up?
Yep.
All right. What's it tied up at?
9.
Excellent.
2-9.
Very good.
9.
20 questions left. Back to Sarah. Comedies now.
Okay.
Oh, God.
The Flint Family, ABC, 1960 to 1966.
The Flintstones.
Tara.
Yes.
In Love with a Witch, ABC 64 to 72.
Bewitched.
Sarah. A Cage Full of Heroes, CBS 65 to 71.
A Cage Full of Heroes.
Yeah.
F Troop?
No. Kind of an awkward show for Germany, I imagine.
Yes.
In the years following the war. That's Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
Tara.
Yes.
Three Girls and Three Boys.
The Brady Bunch.
ABC 69 to 71. Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Male Economics. ABC 1970 to 1975. Male Economics.
M-A-I-L or M-A-L-E?
Oh, like the sex.
Okay.
Male Economics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sitcom.
This can't be right. No. Love American Style?
It's a title that makes sense only when you know what it's about. It's The Odd Couple.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Okay. I see what they did there.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Tara.
Yes.
The Two from the Gas Station, NBC 74 to 78.
The Two from the Gas Station.
Yep.
Sanford and Son.
Chico and the Man.
Oh, God. Okay.
Sarah. Jack of Hearts with Two Queens. ABC 77 to 81.
This is what I was like. It can't be this because it was too early. This is Three's Company.
Nice.
Tara.
Yep.
Chaos Level 10. ABC 88 to 90. Best title so far.
And
I
it's
think.
A sitcom.
Chaos Level 10.
Chaos like, Level 10.
Michael Scott's Threat Level Midnight.
From 88.
Yeah. ABC 88 to 90. Yeah.
God. Oh, man. The Hogan Family.
That was NBC.
Oh.
Just the 10 of Us.
Okay, yeah.
Oh.
That's Chaos Level 10, all right.
Sarah D. Bunting. Three is One Too Many. ABC 84 to 85.
Can you read it again, please?
Three is One Too Many. 84 to 85, ABC.
ABC?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I don't fucking know. Full House? No.
Tara, do you
no.
I guess? It's not Three's Company, it's Three's a crowd.
Oh, that thing.
All right, Tara, this will take us into our next score break.
Okay.
Harry's Miraculous Criminal Court, NBC 84 to 92.
Night Court.
Night Court is correct. Nice. And let's get those scores.
It's still a very, very, very close game. We are no longer tied up. Sarah has 11, I have 12.
All right, everybody's got 5 questions left, so it's still anybody's game.
What?
Sarah D. Bunting. Any more questions, Arnold? ABC and NBC, 78 to 86.
Oh, okay. me. Different strokes.
Well done. Thank you. 2 day points for saying it the correct way.
Worth it.
Tara?
Wow. Sarah is by far our day points leader, by the way. Yes.
A Greek conquers Chicago. ABC 86 to 93.
Perfect Strangers.
Sarah, Sugar Bakers, colon, it doesn't have to be a man. CBS 86 to 93.
Germany, 1 Sarah point for that one. Designing women.
Tara.
Yes.
One Father, Too Many, NBC 87 to 1990.
My two dads.
Sarah D. Bunting, A Horribly Nice Family, Fox, 87 to 97.
97?
Yeah, 10 years. A Horribly Nice Family on Fox, 87 to 97.
Married with Children. Jesus.
Tara.
Mm-hmm.
California High School, NBC, 89 to 93.
Wait, what? Oh, Saved by the Bell.
Correct.
Thank you for the network info.
Quickly scores.
Still super close. Sarah has 14 points. I have 15.
All right. Everybody's got 2 questions left.
Okay.
Sarah. Turn Left After the Moon. NBC, 1996 to 2001. Turn Left After the Moon.
Turn Left After the Moon.
Uh-huh. Just as dumb as a
96 to 2001.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Sitcom.
I don't know. Millennium.
That was a pretty funny show. Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. I always forget that existed.
Yep.
A Trio to Sink Your Teeth Into. ABC, 98 to 2001.
I don't know if these dates line up, but is it 2 guys, a girl, and a pizza place?
Wow.
Wow.
Well done. Sarah. Just Drop It, Larry. HBO 2000 to the present.
That's a great title.
Just Drop It, Larry.
Oh, my God.
She can't remember the name.
The name of the show has, like, completely... I'm having a Tower Records moment where it's like, you know, that thing with the guy. Shit. I don't remember the name of the television program.
Would it help if they hum the theme music to you in the background?
That doesn't help. I don't watch it. Buzz me. I don't know.
Doesn't help. She doesn't know it. Doesn't watch it. Stop. That's not it anyway.
It's my birthday.
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, Arrested Development? That doesn't sound right. Curb Your Enthusiasm. Of course.
All right. Last question for Tara. Mr. Griffin, colon, disinterested in school.
In
NBC,
school?
2018
oh,
to the present.
Oh, AP Bio.
AP Bio. That was great.
I heard Mr. Griffin. I thought it was going to be Family Guy.
All right. Final scores, please, sir.
All right. Very hard-fought battle. Sarah finished with 14 points. I have 17.
All right. That means everybody gets 2 steel meals except for Sarah. Oh. I do have this tiebreaker that we're going to give 1 steel meal to. So you may not go home empty-handed. If you can answer this first, shout it out when you know. It's another comedy.
Okay.
Listen Who's Hammering. ABC 91 to 99.
She got
it. I mean, ding, ding. Correct, Sarah D. Bunting. Home Improvement.
Yeah.
All right, so we end with Sarah with 1 steel meal, Value Guess with 2 steel meals, and Tara with 2 steel meals.
Tara!
Tara.
Congratulations, well done, Tara.
Thank you.
And Value Guess, too, for their free steel meals. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. It was an all-canon extravaganza where we fought Foyle's War, survived the 2 storms at Hill House before spending Easter in Bakersfield with the Baskets. We wrapped it up with a Tara victory in a non-regulation game time that was lost in translation. Next up, we're poaching showrunners and forming new streaming networks on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next Extra Hot Great Prime, we welcome back Fug Girl Heather Cox to discuss the return of Gun and Clum. in Making the Cut. Remember,
we're listening.
Any more questions, Arnold?
Forget about you, Ghost Dad.
This is the end of our first lesson, Conversational French, the language of love. Thank you very much. See you at the next lesson. Remember, keep practicing. Au revoir. Bye. Good luck.